Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Hercules and the Space Gods. I am Hercules. Hercules and the Space Gods is a voyage of discovery that is currently unfolding through our podcast on Mount Olympus and CERN, select chapters in Tim Beckley's paranormal anthologies, a variety of live and now Zoom events, and several articles published in various magazines over the past few years. Hercules and the Space Gods, like all our initiatives, support all of humanity's efforts to transcend this world and venture forth into the great beyond, be they metaphysical, mechanical, or even imaginal. We're going to start tonight's show with If You Can Dream by Virginia Ackley, and then we will proceed to Spaced Out with Bob Vossler.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real.
Greetings and welcome back to Hercules and the Space Gods. And we will now proceed to Spaced Out with Bob Vossler, where we will explore who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. Greetings and welcome, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm very excited tonight because this is the first time we've done a segment on one of my favorite heroes. He's iconic. And he's celebrating 90 years this year. So I'm very grateful that who's joining me from a Facebook page that we're both mutual members of, The Shadow Knows, and that he's agreed to join me tonight. We don't know each other well, but we definitely appreciate The Shadow.
Before you start the show, I would like to return to something we discussed a while ago very quickly. I am ready now to start interacting with your Starfleet organization as an Olympian and to generate activity. So if you can talk with me and we could create a method of interacting officially or unofficially, and then let your members know that if they want to interact with Olympians or be Olympians, to just talk to me, we could start that. It's been like a year and a half in coming. It's finally here.
Exactly. And now we've reached, or at least we're getting very close to reaching the end of this pandemic. So things are opening up, and there's avenues for community service and all kind of other projects that we can interact with. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Me too. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
I said I will definitely find it a good time that we could go over some solid plans.
Thank you, Bob. I greatly appreciate it and look forward to hearing your show tonight. I'll be here if you need me.
Thank you. Thank you, and welcome, Philip. I wasn't sure how to pronounce your last name, so I didn't want to try.
That's okay. I get that a lot. It's Schweier.
Schweier, okay. So, as we know, the shadow began on July 31st, 1930, on the radio. But he, at that time, he was simply the narrator of a radio program, the Detective Hour. He was created by Walter B. Gibson, who was a phenomenal, prolific writer. He was a magician. He had many talents. There's just so much we could cover, but I know we'll start talking about. Phil, how you came to first know the shadow? Was it through the radio show? Was it through the pulps? Was it through comics? Was it through so many different mediums that the shadow has come through?
Yeah, there are so many mediums that have introduced him to fans all over the world. I came to him through comic books back in the early 70s, around 1973. I did a little bit of research earlier today. Summer of 73... Batman 253 featured a team-up between Batman and the Shadow.
Parallel experience. That's great because that's exactly how I was introduced to him. But go ahead.
Right. DC had just launched its Shadow series written by Denny O'Neill. And Denny O'Neill was also writing Batman at the time. And I had the privilege of interviewing Denny for an article. And he said that, you know, there was no real strategy involved to goose the sales of the Shadow comic book that was coming out. He just thought it'd make for a great team up.
And it did. It was great.
Yeah. And they did a follow up about 5 or 6 issues later.
I believe the second story was when he was a child during a bank robbery, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there was a great deal of flashback in that story. Where Bruce Wayne was a young boy before his parents were killed and encountering the Shadow at that time, which kind of alludes back to an earlier statement he made in the earlier story where he tells the Shadow, "You were my greatest inspiration." And so, as a child, he did, he was influenced by the Shadow.
I loved the Denny O'Neill, Mike Kaluta Shadow series. It was so that the artwork was incredible. I must say I was a little disappointed when they moved over with Frank Robbins, although Frank Robbins does tend to capture that era very well with the books that he did. He did The Invaders later on for Marvel and some other books that are, set in the past. But Mike Kaluta was incredible. And I so enjoyed that series and was very disappointed when it ended because I was collecting everything.
I think a lot of fans wish it could have continued a lot longer than it did. I gather that just the sales figures plus their licensing with Condé Nast just made it a bit of a not financially viable for them to continue.
Yeah, I think that was definitely, I had heard something of that, and I believe that Condé Nast is I mean, we could go on that for a while too, because I believe, sadly, they're undergoing some kind of relicensing or something that also recently prevented Dynamite Comics from going forward, and I enjoyed that run as well.
Yes.
Of their original series and some of the others, although I did not get into the Shadow Now, but, you know, that's a topic we could get into later. So did you later on get into some of the other forms, like the radio show?
Absolutely. It kind of happened in stages. My sister came home from the public library shortly after, you know, I became a comic book fan, and she had these two books, Jim Steranko's History of Comics. And in it, he addresses the pulps and the Shadow specifically. And so that kind of gave me the background. I was just eating up anything about the history of comics and superheroes. And, you know, I'm like 8, 9 years old. And so she brought these books home that, you know, I got these at the public library. It's like, that's impossible. I've looked for stuff like this. They were in the grown-up section where I never went. So that kind of introduced me to the history of the character. And then later, again at the public library, I discovered they had record albums of the old radio shows. So I explored those. And then in the 70s, a few years later, as I'm hitting 12, 13, 14 years old, Belmont and Pyramid were publishing paperback reprints with Jim Steranko covers. And I was buying those up.
So, I met him at one of the pulp shows that I would later go to that were in my area. I bought one of his prints and got his autograph and talked to him for a bit. And I am proud to say I've got it in my home. It had a woman in a, you might even be familiar with the story. She's kind of in like in a giant test tube in a rather provocative outfit. And the Shadow is there to
rescue her, per se.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that very same print. I've met him before. I met him at Dragon Con, and he's very fan friendly. He loves to talk to the fans. And he will tell you, you know, when you're done and you're leaving his table, he'll say, look, you come back later, we'll talk some more. I know he says that to every fan that comes across him. But he knows
he's quite friendly and quite a character. He has an interesting history all himself, you know.
Yes. He also is a magician of sorts, an escape artist.
Yeah. I fell in love with the radio show as well, even with its differences. Yeah. You know, and for those not familiar, they kind of went in a totally different direction than the pulps, having to drop the agent of that. The Shadow has a group of like a team, much like for fans of Doc Savage, you know, but much more. For purposes of the radio, of course, they wanted to simplify it, so you know, they dropped the whole agents. I think the idea, which is why they introduced Margot Lane, because they wanted a female voice to distinguish. They at the time felt in 1937, when the Shadow, you know, stood out on his own to be his own, you know, his own character rather than a narrator. They introduced her so that there would be, you know, a point counterpoint, you know, within the story. So if they had too many male voices, they felt there might be some confusion. So
I think the radio show, you know, there are people that generally prefer one or the other. And I think the radio show is equally valid as part of the Shadow lore. You know, as much as Adam West is a part of Batman and Michael Keaton too, you know, they're different versions of the same character. And that's wonderful to have. If it brings people to fandom, I'm all for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think in some ways the 1994 movie, kind of blended elements of both together.
Yes, I would agree.
And I wasn't going to go to that this early, but I enjoyed the movie. I really did. I was also disappointed that they didn't make enough to make a sequel to it, because
True.
I would have loved to have seen a sequel. I know for purists, you know, those who really stick to either the pulps or the radio, they probably, you know, there was probably aspects of it, and there were areas where they did go a little over the top, but I thought it had a great cast, and you know, added a few extra things that changed a few things, but you know, that's going to happen in any adaptation.
Yes. And, you know, one of those things I think that they added was that code phrase of the sun is shining, but the ice is slippery, as a means for the shadow agents to identify one another. I've heard diehard fans, the real purists, just, you know, kind of look at that as, you know, with scorn and derision. And I'm thinking, like you, that every time there's an adaptation of a property, there's always something new added. And if that's the only thing that was added to The Shadow, I'll live with it and embrace it, actually.
Right. I thought that the Margot Lane relationship actually made more sense, and I didn't mind the psychic link between the two of them. I thought that that was actually an interesting idea to bring them together. And Margot has been, depending on which depiction, you know, what medium, Margot goes from kind of almost ditzy in certain radio shows, and it's certainly, you know, the two serials, or I shouldn't say that, in the serials, but that's a whole other aspect. I wasn't too fond of those, but and then is kind of very gritty and you know, in some of the comic book adaptations, especially in Dynamite. And then in this one, she was a socialite, and, you know, her. I think they added a good aspect with her father. Sorry, my puppies are getting a little rambunctious here. I usually don't have them while the show's going on. I thought Sean Conn was well played, was well cast.
One thing that I liked about Margot Lane in that movie was I got the idea that Lamont Cranston was chosen for a specific reason, perhaps his, you know, latent mental abilities that the Tolkien taught him in the film. And he identified that Margot had similar mental telepathy abilities. And that kind of helps form this psychic link that maybe that's how he chooses his agents, or, you know, people that he can maybe reach out to from a distance and perhaps guide by remote control, not in a manipulative way, but in a means to help and perhaps, you know, send one to the rescue of another or something like that. And so that's kind of how I looked at that psychic link that they added for Lamont and Margot in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it worked.
Yeah, I do, and I believe that had a sequel gone forward, they were planning on having the voodoo master, Dr. Radil
Mokino.
I'm not sure. Mokino.
Yes.
I mean, they already had the. I don't know if you have any of the action figures, but I did pick up some as well, and I don't know if that's the way he really was supposed to look in either the movie. He certainly doesn't look that way in any of the pulp drawings, and I don't know if he ever made it into the comic book, any of the comic versions. But
none that I've read.
I think
that back. I think there was one that Dynamite published that featured him. It might have been one of the team-up books where they had the Shadow with Doc Savage or the Shadow with the Green Hornet, one of those, where they introduced him as a second villain. I'm just not sure which one it might have been.
Well, the comics, I think generally the comics have been very true to the spirit of the pulp and have been very entertaining, with a few exceptions. One
yes.
being, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, prior to DC's excellent first outing with the Shadow in the 1970s, Archie Comics somehow acquired the rights and mm-hmm. did a abhorrent version where they even changed him in the second issue to have a superhero costume of
green and blue tights and a mask.
Yeah. Oh, it was. I must say, I never actually read an issue, but I've heard so much about. I've seen some of the drawings, and
yeah.
I know where they were, what they were thinking when they were doing.
I managed to get my hands on the first issue, and it kind of tried to be faithful to the original concept. But I think they just thought, you know, we'll hook them with the first one and kind of build on the established audience, and then we'll take them in this new direction. Because, you know, it was the 60s and everybody was trying to do something new, you know, like Marvel.
Right.
Was, I think.
Oh, and especially Archie. You know, Archie was not known for their superheroes, although I believe they started with superheroes first, then went to the success of Archie, and then, it changed the whole name to the Archies. It was so successful with
right.
all their Mighty Crusaders line with the Shield and the Fly and the Web.
Jaguar.
Yeah. So that, I don't even know how long that lasted. But
I believe
probably
that was 8 issues. And
wow.
some of them
okay.
were written by Joe Shuster, who co-created Superman.
Yes, yes.
I suspect that was kind of an editorial edict of, Joe, we want you to write this character as we have designed him to be. And Joe, being having the pedigree of creating Superman, he says, okay, if that's where my check, if that's what my paycheck depends on, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
So,
and at that time, I know he was he was hurting because, you know, everyone knows that he didn't. They sold the rights to Superman.
Yes.
You know, years earlier, and didn't get any kind of what you would consider residuals or anything like that. So
right.
you know, he was definitely doing what he had to do. So why they didn't just call it a different character or the the Green Shadow or something like that? But it was just.
Sure.
But then, we had DC, and then DC did that very strange version with Howard Chaykin. I don't know how you felt about that. But
I happen to be a big fan of Howard Chaykin even before he did The Shadow. So this is kind odd blending of two things that I liked. Would I like them together? I didn't know. But I think I did. It was an interesting experiment. I liked the direction he went in. The ongoing series that followed, not so much. I think that was too much. Them trying too hard with a good thing. Not great thing, but good thing. And it kind of just fizzled from there, I'm sorry to say.
You mean the rest of the series that he did, or were you referring to the Shadow Strikes?
Well, he did the 4-issue miniseries, which I liked. And then because of that success, they launched an ongoing series that was written by Andy Helfer, who had been Chaykin's editor on his 4-issue miniseries. And it was drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz for the first 6 issues. And it just kind of continued the storyline as Chaykin did, with
mm-hmm.
The Shadow in New York circa 1987, 86, something like that. And it just went in bizarre directions. They created these agents that were not as likable. They were interesting, but maybe not as likable as his original team of agents. And then toward the end of the series, it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder.
Yeah. When I saw that they had just had his head in some kind of robotic thing, I mean, I have some of those. And I was like, it was a little too weird for me. But I think after that, then they had the Shadow Strikes, which brought
was
it
phenomenal.
Back.
Phenomenal.
That was great. I loved that. And they really fleshed out Margot more. They fleshed out the agents more. I really loved that version, that run.
Yes, that was an excellent series, and it doesn't get the credit it's due.
Especially I think it was early on when they had Rasputin and that whole storyline, mm-hmm. and they explained about the ring, the Garrosol, and all of that. And it was pretty, a lot of adult material in there. You have this continuity, which that's the only thing that I think the earlier DC, of the 70s we probably would have liked to have seen more of that. But, back then, storytelling was done a little differently with comic books, and you have more self-contained stories, and, it was more of a mystery series, whereas that one, ran the span of several issues.
Yes.
Which was very enjoyable.
And it featured the first team-up ever of The Shadow mm-hmm. and Doc Savage, which,
yeah.
After 60-some years, it's like, well, why hasn't this happened already? Well, here you go.
Yeah. Well, the DC comic of the 70s did bring The Shadow and The Avenger together, but he was a very obscure,
yes.
he was a very obscure punk character. And not nearly as famous as Doc Savage. But I enjoyed the Doc Savage crossover. And he's been paired up with, as we spoke, Batman, the Avenger, Doc Savage, of course. There was kind of an unofficial pairing between him and the Rocketeer in one of the Rocketeer. Mostly him in Lamont Cranston, but I think for legal reasons they couldn't,
identify him that way. Yes.
Yeah, directly identify him.
He was referred to as Mr. Jonas. To go with the nameplate on the secret mail drop that he used.
Yeah. The Ghost, which I don't have, which was more of a modern character from some other company, maybe Dark Horse, because Dark Horse did also own the rights around the 90s, because they did the adaptation of the movie, and they did mm-hmm. some specials. They did a series where they had some short stories, which were actually,
yes.
Not bad. And they were
yes.
for very short stories, they were kind of good. I liked the pairing of the original Green Hornet and the Shadow. That was interesting because Margot Lane and Lenore Chase apparently were college buddies or something.
I like
together.
It.
Yeah, that was interesting. And of course you had the typical at first, they're at odds, the Shadow.
It's kind of a cliche, and I've heard, comic pros at conventions talk about that, it's kind of expected that at first they're going to fight each other, and then they realize that they share a common enemy, and then they team up. And you see that in just about every team up between two characters you'll ever see.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the Shadow and the Green Hornet, both at times, especially the Green Hornet, are always, being pursued by the police anyway.
Yeah.
So it's easy to say, well, he's wanted by the law. He must be a bad guy. So I was able to get a copy, and I was searching for it for years, of Hitler's Astrologer. That paired Denny O'Neill and Mike Kaluta back together again.
Yes, that Marvel Comics published.
Yes, like the only time Marvel got involved with the character, and really it was it read like a DC property because it was self-contained.
contained, and it was but rather a large story. It was I enjoyed it. Set during World War II.
Right. Or about. I found it disappointing. The last chapter, it doesn't really end so much as it just stops. I was expecting, you know, some final comment from the shadow
too.
Of the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. And but there's just this, the last panel is just this random houseboat out on the water with a, you know, silhouetted figure on the deck. And I'm thinking, well, okay, what does this mean?
Yeah, I did feel it was very anticlimactic. I mean, I guess I was just infatuated with seeing, you know,
the two colonial and polluted together again.
Yeah.
It's my understanding, again, in this interview that I did with Denny O'Neill, that he wrote the story. It was sent to Mike Kaluta. Kaluta was going to pencil it, and Bernie Wrightson was going to ink it. And he Kaluta didn't really like the story, and so he started changing it a little bit at first. And O'Neill went to the editor, Larry Hama, and said, you know, I'm not comfortable here. And Larry was saying, it's okay, don't worry about it, everything will be all right. I think one of the reasons Larry was so sunshine and roses about it was because he left Marvel partway through the book. So it ended up getting passed to another editor. Bernie Wrightson dropped out of the project, and then there was this mad scramble to find an inker to take over. And Mike Kaluta had been drawing, expecting, well, Bernie Wrightson will, you know, he'll take up for my weaknesses and fill in these stuff that I'm not really good at. There was a good sense of collaboration when the two of them were working together. They had been studio mates for years. But now without Wrightson, then suddenly Kaluta, you know, now has to kind of be a little more hands-on with the penciling. And so then they got the name's escaping me for the moment. Russ Heath. They got Russ Heath, who had drawn a lot of war comics back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and Westerns. And so they got him to ink it, and he did a great job. But I don't think it was a good match for Kaluta's penciling.
Yeah.
They weren't a good pairing.
When I finally picked it up, and it was at a toy collectible show of all places, and it was still wrapped up in the plastic, you know, for all of $7, and I saw it from across the way, and I was like, oh my God, I finally found it, you know, because you'll find things at the weirdest times and places, but when I finally got to open it up, which was probably that night, I was a little surprised by, you know, because I was expecting, probably out of nostalgia, I was kind of expecting kind of the same kind of artwork that I saw in the 70s issue. And it looked a little, I don't know, weak, different, whatever. You know, it just didn't have the same, you know.
Flair?
Flair, yeah. We haven't touched on the Dynamite run. What did you think of that? You know, that
some of it I liked, some of it I'm not especially fond of. But again, you know, the idea that it's out there and hopefully attracting new fans, I don't discount it. I thought Matt Wagner's Shadow Year One was excellent. I think he has a very firm grasp of pulp material. And he's done some Batman stories set like back in the 40s to kind of really build on the original Bob Kane era of Batman. And so the Shadow Year One, I think, is really a great story. The team up with Doc Savage and the Avenger that Michael Uslan wrote, that was kind of a fanboy's wet dream, you know, just – three great pulp heroes right here all together for the first time, only time ever. And it really kind of built on some of the lore that was established all those years ago.
Well, you brought up Mike Uslan's name. He was attached to a, unfortunately, aborted film project,
yes.
You know, that would have been around the 2000s sometime. I know there has been a couple of different ideas kicking around. Sam Raimi, you know, he was trying to get a project going. And I mean, there's still hopes out there. Although I believe with, I don't know what's happening with this whole thing that I read in Dynamite Comics or somewhere about Condé Nast and the rights. But it seemed like you weren't going to see any kind of project for the Shadow at the moment. I don't know if you know anything about that.
I don't know anything, you know, hard and detailed and legitimate. My theory is that Condé Nast realizes that they have this intellectual property. They just don't know how best to exploit it in a successful way. You know, they had Anthony Tolan doing the reprints of the old pulps.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, Anthony Tolan was approaching the finish line of doing all the Shadow stories, of reprinting all of them, and he was very close to completing that library when they told him that the contract was going to expire and they were choosing not to renew it. And, you know, it's sad that they didn't let him finish, because, you know, if he'd have had another 6 or 8 months, he would have finished it, I believe.
Yeah.
And so it would have been I think it was a disservice to the fans to not let him finish it. And I think I suspect part of the reason they did that was because they were thinking, well, this has worked okay, but we want to introduce new younger audiences to it. And that's how the Bruce Patterson book that is coming out soon, or is it Bruce Patterson? The writer, the mystery writer?
James Patterson.
James Patterson,
but
I'm sorry.
I've been very, and again, I know the old adage is you don't judge a book by its cover, but if you did judge the book by its cover, it didn't seem to give me the Shadow vibe.
Right.
And I've heard some, unfortunately, and some of it on our mutual page that we're on, has talked about how this is not really the Shadow. And I don't even know if it's set in the past or the present. I'm not sure.
It's my understanding it's set in current day. And
yeah.
It's kind of a reboot, is my understanding. I haven't read it, and I haven't read anything about it. I am hopeful, but only up to a point. And like
yeah,
so I... many reboots, the successful reboots are few and far between. And I think in this case, the publisher is alienating their core audience of longtime Shadow fans.
Yeah.
And I don't expect it to be successful. I would like it to be. I would like it to bring new fans in. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how it attracts those fans.
Exactly. And I know that like you, I usually try to be more optimistic and open-minded to things, but I think when it comes to, and you've seen it on the page, when the topic comes up of the Shadow and bringing him into modern times, I'm definitely one of those fans that feel that the Shadow, you know, belongs within the 30s, 40s. Maybe you could even eke him into the 50s, but I don't want to see the Shadow in 2021.
Right.
I'm not a fan of that. We have so many heroes, you know, now, and I think part of that atmosphere, part of his allure is the film noir style, that the time period is almost a part of him and those stories. It's like taking the Lone Ranger and Tonto
out of
and moving them up.
you know, like nobody thinks to do that. I mean, I know there's been an effort with Zorro, and that didn't go well. And actually, they put the Phantom way in the future, in 2040 or something like that, which actually isn't that far away now. But back in the 70s or 80s or 90s, they did that show series. But I want to see the Shadow circa, you know,
1935.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think one of the things that,
you know, but
I think one of the things about setting the Shadow in the 1930s, there are two aspects to it. One, you don't have heat sensors, you don't have motion detectors, you don't have a lot of this electronic surveillance that you have nowadays. And a lot of the Shadow, what he does is he skulks around, he prowls around, hides in the nighttime, and all that modern technology is, you know, how does he overcome it in the modern era? And, you know, it's an interesting proposition to theorize about. But back then, you know, that's part of his shtick. And so you really can't have him in modern times. The other thing is, back then, it was easy to have, as villains, generic gangsters who they're bad because they're criminals. Why are they criminals? Because they're bad. It's kind of like Indiana Jones and Nazis. They're kind of your all-purpose bad guys. It's easy to dislike them just because of who they are. And now with the Shadow, it's like terrorism and drug dealers and, you know, these modern threats that we have that make being a crime fighter on a whole different level. And, like you say, it's really not the era they belong in.
I totally agree. And if you want to see them use any kind of technological advancement, well, we've got Batman for that. I mean, you know, like, it's taking a hero. It's as bad as the Archie version of making him this kind of, you know, changing him into a spandex cape-wearing superhero, where his allure, everything that is, you know, badass about the Shadow is nicked right into the time period. Who was your favorite of his many agents? You know, there's, besides Margot, of course, but there's Harry Vincent and Mo Shrevitz and Clyde Burke and Burbank,
I think I like Clyde Burke best because he's a newspaper man, and that's where I got my start, was working for newspapers. And so I kind of really appreciate, you know, the reporter chasing down the story aspect of it, and, you know, the investigative abilities of a journalist.
Yeah. My goodness, Phil, we have so much in common. One of the reasons I was here tonight is that I'm back into the full-time reporting game, with having done it for more than 30 years, and was never dreamed that this council meeting would that usually is not anything more than a half hour, would drag on to that point. And I couldn't just abruptly leave because I was from where I was sitting, I was blocking a, you know, where the podium was to speak. So it took me a while to get out of there. I like Clyde Burke too, you know, and for that reason, I always thought that was interesting, you know, and I love it when they do bring reporters into stories, even with Superman. It's like, no, they're not going to send two reporters on, you know, even back then they didn't have the budget to do that, you know, things like that, you know. So I love, you know, looking to see what reporters and newspapers would actually have done in certain situations.
Exactly.
Even back then, you know, I know things were a little different back then. What do you think the odds are that eventually we will see a new treatment of the Shadow, either as a film, maybe now with the event of, you know, streaming services that could do a series, like a 13 episode, even a 10 episode, I'll be happy with that. You know, which would really be able to show more, to be more film noir, to be more, you know, violent when necessary.
HBO did Perry Mason last year. Yeah. And I didn't see it. I understand, you know, for Perry Mason fans, they enjoyed it. It was a little bit different than they expected. But, you know, from a visual standpoint, they seemed to enjoy it, at least, you know, the two fans that I spoke with did. And I think if they can get somebody, a writer and director, who understand the Shadow and appreciate the character and the property, there's a possibility there. If Condé Nast can kind of let a fan kind of be in control, I mm-hmm. think they'll be satisfied with the results that come back. If they're not bean counters and they're looking to maximize their dollars, if they just want a successful, profitable project and kind of curb their business acumen for, you know, to where they can be satisfied with staying in the black, then I think there's a real shot. And then, of course, there's the casting of who would play Lamont Cranston / Kent Allard / The Shadow. You know, mm-hmm. who that actor might be, I have no idea. It seems every 4 or 5 years, or not even, you know, we see this face, or at least I do. I think he would make a good Lamont Cranston. And then, you know, the project never happens, and they age out of the possibility. But,
yeah,
you know, as you and I have both seen on Facebook, you know, every so often somebody throws up a photo saying, what do you think of this guy? And, you know, there are mixed reactions of yays or nays. And, you know, maybe someday somebody will listen to us.
I have done the same thing. I remember a friend, it was one friend's birthday, and he wanted to go see the live movie Speed Racer. So the three of us went out, watched Speed Racer, I loved the cartoon, but the movie was, you know, but all I got out of that movie was sitting there and suddenly realizing that Driver X, if you're familiar with Speed Racer, Driver X, played by the actor who was the star of Lost, and I'm afraid I don't recall his name because I haven't seen him in anything recently. And I just sat there and I thought, oh, my God, look at that nose. He's a handsome guy. Mm-hmm. He's got his nose. He would be perfect. Get him out of this movie, although he wasn't a good Driver X. But I was like, that's what he should be doing next. They got to cast him for that. And every so often, you know, like you, I think of the same thing of like, I mean, now that was more than 10 years ago. I mean, I don't, mm-hmm. I haven't really seen him lately. But there were so many different actors that, you know, I would love to see in certain roles.
Now, we only have a few more minutes and we really haven't discussed the Pulp much.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
And
late.
This is the way good conversations go. Is like just kind of flash by and blip. But I've read a lot of the Pulps, and there was a time when you could find them, you know, downloadable on the internet. And then Condé Nast lawyers got aggressive with their copyright issues. And they were right, too, because some of those websites were really out of control when it came to making this material available. But I've read a lot of the Pulps, and, you know, there's definitely an evolution, especially in the later years, where he's less of a spectral figure prowling, you know, the underworld, and he's more just Lamont Cranston, super detective. And, you know, some of the Pulps are very enjoyable. They're moody. They're atmospheric. They've got interesting plot twists. Some of them, they're just good old-fashioned adventure stories. And for the most part, I love the Pulps as well. You know, those that I've read, you know, like I say, there have been some disappointments, but they're few and far between.
I have one or two of the collections that had some of the Pulp stories in them. But I've never actually owned a Pulp. I've gone to Pulp shows. I thought I would buy a number of them, and then I saw the price tag.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting going to Pulp shows, and just you walk in and you just, that smell. You know you're at a Pulp show.
Yeah.
Not to say that the hotel was that, might have also been the hotel I was at, but I enjoyed them. I missed this fall. They usually have them in the fall, of course, because of the pandemic. We didn't have it this year, or this past year, maybe this coming fall. But I enjoy them, and I know that some of the stories actually have very little of the shadow in it, and put the agents out there, and then he kind of swoops in at the very end and pulls everything together. I know that was certain stories, maybe early on.
I think he kind of played a master manipulator in some, like you say.
Some aren't even his agents. Some were like, I believe there was one where I was new to this, and he was kind of feeding him clues, and, and then towards the end, he saved him, or, but basically it was this character that was doing all the really heavy lifting.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. I know a lot of them have what John Olson of The Shadow reviews referred to as a proxy hero. And usually it's some young guy who's, trying to find his grandparents' fortune or, and he's kind of the main character, and he's kind of, unbeknownst to him, he's under the protection of the Shadow himself. And then he'll, the Shadow will send Harry Vincent to kind of partner up with him for the duration of the story. And, it's a broad range of stories from buried treasures to mad scientists with inventions and all manner of, catastrophes that can take place.
I think there was one story that was translated to the radio version, which it had to do with stopping time. Was that one of the pulps? I know it was a radio show, but I thought it was based on one of the pulp stories.
I can't say as I recall. It may be one of the ones I have not read, or it may be one that I read so long ago, it's just not registering in my memory.
Speaking of books, I didn't know this until today, and I can't believe I did. A publishing house called Altus Press came out in 2015 with the novel The Sinister Shadow. Were you familiar with that one?
Yes.
Where he masquerades as George Clarendon, a celebrated criminologist and former Cobalt member and friend of Commissioner Ralph Weston. I don't know how I missed that, but I would like to pick that up somewhere.
If I understand you correctly, there's a Doc Savage book by that title, The Sinister Shadow, that was published a few years back where, yes, they do team up in book form, presumably for the first time.
Okay, it's a team up. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then there's Will Patrick Murray, who's, much revered for his knowledge of the Shadow and pulps in general. He was writing these wild adventures of Doc Savage, supposedly from notes of Lester Dent and outlines that were never used. And so he's taken some of these stories and fleshed them out. And two of them, I don't know if this is the original intent, two of them feature the Shadow, where they're paired again, fighting crime. So, there is that to look forward to if you're not familiar with them. And they're probably still available through Amazon or through the website, The Wild Adventures of Doc Savage. I think that's the title of the website.
I'll have to check that out. I know there was there three or maybe even six books done in the 1960s that I believe they had commissioned Walter Gibson to do, but they didn't actually allow him to do them or something like that. I forgot what the story was behind that. But
don't know the circumstances behind that. I know they wanted to revive them in paperback form. Gibson wrote the first one, and then there were like seven or eight more after that were written by Dennis Lynds, L-Y-N-D-S. And the reason that's so fresh in my memory is because I just finished one of those not too long ago. I'm kind of working my way through those books. And again, the Shadow is very much not like we perceive him to be. He's kind of, it's the mid-60s, James Bond is all the rage, so they kind of turn him into this super secret agent fighting communism and saboteurs and international counterfeiters and that sort of thing. So,
wow.
You know, it's a different take. But, you know, as I'm reading this, I'm trying to remember, it's the 60s. It's kind of just a different version. It's okay.
Yeah, I thought that they had said it during the time period the book came out, which was the 60s.
Yes.
And I don't know how they handled that, if it was just, hey, this is the Shadow in the 60s and didn't really, you know, go back, you know, show him resurrected or anything like that from the past, you know, or
right.
say that he just lived on. So I guess if Margot's there, she's just the Margot of the 1960s or something like that. Or do they use any of the characters?
They do use Margot. I've not come across any of the other agents yet. Well, no, I take that back. They do feature Commissioner Weston and Detective Cardona. So, you know, they still are using some of the cast, maybe not the agents so much. But it also seems to lend itself more to the radio version of The Shadow rather than the pulp version. And honestly, I don't mind what they've done with the character creatively, but manuscripts themselves are just so horribly, horribly edited, if they were edited at all, because there's just so many inconsistencies, so many repetitive phrases. I just, you know, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, God, did anybody look this over before it went to press? You know, and that's the journalist in me that's just cringing at some of this phrasing and the descriptions, and it's just horribly, horribly edited that way.
And I hate to interrupt at this point, but we only have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to give you both a chance to share your contact information.
Okay. Well, mine is still the same. USS Challenger on Facebook and www.usschallenger.org. And Phil seems to be a big enthusiast of the Shadow, obviously. So I don't know if he's got a group or anything like that.
Don't have a group. I'm active on Facebook with the two Shadow pages, The Shadow Knows and The Shadow Strikes. I've been a writer for comicbookbin.com for about 15, 16 years now. And I've got bunches of essays, some to do with The Shadow, some just comic books in general, and interviews and stuff like that that archive back to 2004.
Oh, wow.
If you're looking for my stuff, that's the best place. See it. Comicbookbin.com.
Okay. I also put a link to The Shadow Knows, and I'm looking for the Shadow Strikes on Facebook. But I'll comicbookbin.com, right?
Correct.
Okay, thanks to both of you. This was a fun show. I was a big Shadow fan back in the day. I used to have tons of the recorded episodes. I had the paperbacks. I had the comics. All sorts of Shadow stuff. So it was very pleasant becoming reacquainted with that stuff again. So I wish you great success in both of your endeavors and hope to have you on again. And thanks to everybody who joined us, whether you joined us live or whether you're going to join us later on demand. Until next time, this is all of us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we'll close with Golden Bow for our last few seconds, also by reading that. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
She stood with the stars in her eyes, and the tree. The wise time stood still, and the bitter heard her sighs, and they danced to the music. wake up her cries. Lady of Moonlight, Lady of Day,